Hi, this is John Ryan. This is part two of the rules discussion with Chris Durall.
He's ready to go. I would like to think that goes without saying. You know?
We'll see. I mean, if we get some such situations, how to handle it and what are the reactions.
All right. Well, but we could talk more on this rule, but...
Let's go on.
We need to move on, because this rule might cause some more conversation, and I started to talk about the basketballization of handball. And I don't think there's anything more controversial in handball, especially high-level games, than the subjective nature of calling passive play and giving a turnover to the ball, to the other team. Just to reiterate, passive play, it's a call that the referees would make if they judge that the team is not being offensively aggressive. And the problem historically has been no consistency from one team to another, or from one refereeing pair to another, or from one point in the game to another point in the game.
Exactly.
And, you know, this is where the discussion has been, you know, why don't we add a shot clock to handball? How would that work? Would that just change the nature of the game? You know, would the defenses become, you know, more passive because they know that the shot clock's going to expire? A lot of discussion on this. I've heard that they have tried shot clocks in other places, or like in like a Russian league many years ago, and you can get into that. But here, the new proposal is essentially the six pass rule. After the referees raising their hand as a forewarning for passive play, the team now has six passes to shoot on goal. And basically, you know, once you get to that sixth pass, you need to shoot the next time.
Yep.
And boy, I am really, it's really going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I'll let you give me your perspective on how you see this. Yep. And the intent on this, and maybe why not a shot clock.
Well, you know, you are right in about the shot clock having been discussed for decades. I was absolutely shocked when I was first exposed to it in a very tangible way. I came to a symposium in then what we called Yugoslavia back in the 1970s, in the days when what we then knew as Soviet Union fervently used and pushed for this idea internationally with the help of some other Eastern Europeans. And it had some momentum, and it even continued after that. I showed up at an event that combined a symposium and a sort of a tournament that was meant to illustrate this rule. And suddenly, without preparation, I was thrown into a game between two of the top nations in the world who were used to playing with this rule. And I had to sort of try to adapt quickly. Now, but leaving that aside, I think gradually the idea of a shot clock has had less and less sort of support around the world of handball. And instead, after some attempts to say, oh, well, we take care of it exclusively by better education, better game understanding on the part of referees, then one has swung over instead to some other more objective way, like what we now see. But the one thing you have to remember is that there are two stages of the referees judging of passive play. And the first one, how soon in an attack do they show the hand signal that the team is being warned about the referee seeing a tendency to passive play? And that remains totally subjectively. So that is still, I mean, likely to cause accusations of inconsistency or referees being not being tactically smart in recognizing in passive play quickly enough, or not having the guts to show the hand signal quickly enough. So the new rule only takes care of the second part. How soon after they show their hand signal are they required to take action? And there, of course, it sounds so simple, six passes. Well, I mean, if as a referee you cannot count to six, you probably have no business being out there on the court, if you put it smartly. But the crux, of course, is that it adds an element, a new bit of a complication for the referees managing the game situation, and at the same time accurately, because everyone else sitting back in the spectator seats can easily see when it gets to six, and
let's take that to another level, because I was just thinking about this. I'm more of a fan of rugby union,
yeah,
but there is also rugby league, where you basically, kind of like American football, you get four plays, and so they on the TV screen it'll say like first phase,
yeah,
second phase, you know, so that anytime the player goes to the ground, that counts as a play.
Yeah.
And so they have to, you know, basically like American football, you have to go for it on fourth down, or you got to punt the ball.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a little pass count in the lower right hand of the screen, you know, well, saying that this is the fourth pass, the fifth pass?
I hope not. We don't want to embarrass the poor referees too much.
Is there going to be another table official? He will be the official pass counter, and there'll be a little thing on the scoreboard that will say this is the fourth pass, the fifth pass, the sixth pass. Because you're right. You know, sometimes, you know, people aren't sure. You know, be like, well, let's take it a little step further. We'll go old school. Let's talk about Dirty Harry.
Yep.
You don't know if I passed five times or six.
Yeah.
You know, do you feel lucky? You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, but that's the simpler part of it. There are other aspects that are more complicated, because, I mean, you know, of course, basically that the rule is that if the referees have shown the hand signal for passive, and that sort of spurs the defense on to go out and do something really conspicuous, that gives them a penalty, a yellow card or a two-minute penalty. Then, of course, the arms come down and the attackers are no longer playing under the threat of passive. That's sort of pretty simple and straightforward. That it isn't changing. But, of course, what you now can expect for sure is that smart defenders will be instructed to go out, and even more than ever before, put pressure and disrupt the passing of the attackers. And in other words, not just sort of prevent, I mean, someone to receive the ball when it's passed to him or her, and in which case, as it happens, the pass, it doesn't count as a pass if someone not through their own fault, couldn't grab the ball. And also, of course, simply to go out and, you know, without using excessive means, grabbing, tying up the attackers so that they cannot get a good passing scheme going. And, of course, that means that it pretty quickly and effectively ruins the chances of the teams of doing something meaningful with this maximum six passes they've allocated. So there is some kind of general admonition under the new rule that, oh, well, you know, of course, the referees have to watch out for that and not tolerate that on the part of the defense. So that becomes another element of judgment that is not so easy.
Yes, so that's the case. If you foul, it doesn't stop the, you know, if there's a free throw, or 9-meter throw, however you want to describe it,
yeah,
it doesn't change the number of passes.
Right.
Because think about it, if you did have that changed, I think that would also have an impact on how the defense is played.
Yeah, and I mean, then it would leave it open for the attackers to go in and let themselves happily be tied up over right. and over in terms of letting even more time go on the clock.
But in a sense, that's kind of how it is now. You know, you don't want to, you know, depending on the stage of the game, you know, you don't want to tie them up and let them run off another 7-8 seconds, however you want to factor it in.
Yeah. But that's correct, John, that it's not different in that sense from what it is today. But today, then, the referees subjectively can take that into account. They can add a little bit more time and be a little bit more generous with the attackers if the defenders are, so to speak, sabotaging. And conversely, if the attackers are seen as going in and letting themselves be tied up voluntarily, then they can be more quick in actually calling the passive. But now, you know, even if the referees will be allowed to call passive on the third or fourth pass if it's too conspicuous, you can bet that the referees will be very hesitant to do that. They will wait till the sixth pass has been used up.
Yes, that's another aspect. It doesn't necessarily have to be six passes. If they feel that that it's really bogus stalling, if you will, passive play, if you will, they can call it earlier. It's just that the sixth one, it's definitely going to be called.
Yeah. But here come into play two of the comments that I offered up front. You know, it's on the one hand, I was saying that, well, it's well-intended and it's probably a good approach that they are trying, but there, as we already indicated, there are more complications to it than one would want for both the teams and as particular referees. But on the other hand, it's yet again a rule where the IHF insists just by having this explicit limit of six, objective limit of six passes, that it's sort of is intended to put pressure on the teams so that it never gets to the point that the referees have to apply this rule. And that's what they tell me unofficially from practice games, from the Junior World Championships, that the teams get so frantic because they are under this new pressure that they, with crazy shots and failed passes, throwing the ball away, that they, in fact, are taking care of it themselves without the referees having to step in and take action, that they actually do get rid of the ball successfully or more likely unsuccessfully within the six passes.
Sure. I'm not sure how this is going to play out, though, with more experienced teams.
No, that I'm curious to see also if it really will come out the same way when smart coaches get the hang of this, both on defense and offense, how they can use that to their advantage.
And here's what I think. I think you kind of highlighted how it doesn't really solve the problem. You know, you still are going to have the issue of when are you going to do the warning sign?
Yeah.
You're still going to have strangeness in the game, or, you know, it's just not going to be a normal flow after that warning. It's still going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And I think it's not going to solve it, and I think it's going to increase interest in a shot clock. That's my take.
If this has as many problems as you and I, and or new complications or new points of debate that you and I have been speculating about here, that might in fact be defective if they have to conclude that, well, no, this doesn't really work that way. Well, at the elite level, we have to look for something totally different. Well, yeah, who knows?
Yeah. And, you know, I guess I would be really interested in seeing how shot clock experiments have worked. I mean, I you know, watching handball, I've kind of come to the conclusion, I've watched some games and kind of kept track of how long a possession typically lasts.
Yeah.
And it's 20 to 25 seconds usually. Somewhere in that ballpark. I mean, somebody should actually really do some thorough investigation of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, set the clock to 25 seconds and see how that plays out. Yeah.
John, you are right that one has to take into account how our sport has developed. When I those experiments that I was sort of found myself shocked to be part of back 40 years ago, then the standard shot clock in the Soviet Union and that they pushed for was 60 seconds, which of course by today's fast and actual field handball would be absolutely absurd. Then I think it was changed to 45. But you considered it today, you couldn't possibly set it higher than 30 because then it would be ridiculous.
Yeah. I can't imagine a game with 60-second possessions.
But John, I should insert then that from the coaching side, the experts who have been arguing that we should forget all this about having a shot clock, the fact that the attacks are so much shorter, that the speed of the attacks and the generally the movements up and down the court are so much faster, and that handball you could be described as so much more action-filled than in 20, 30, 40 years ago. Sure. That's their argument why a shot clock would be inappropriate. But easy.
I would counter that argument in saying it's just like, a lot of times you have these rules just so that people are aware of them and it never has to be implemented. I would like to think that it's something that would only come into play towards the end of a game.
Yeah.
And you take an NBA game.
Yeah.
When does the shot clock only become a factor? Occasionally there'll be like a good defensive set earlier in the game where for whatever reason they, have to throw one off real quick. But most of the time it comes into play at the end of the game and how the time becomes more, the time on that clock becomes more of a factor. And that's when you need that rule to, prevent, manipulation of the game. If the NBA did not have a shot clock, that last 3 or 4 minutes of a game would be very painful to watch. It already is because of
the last three, 4 minutes of the game on the clock, or on my watch, so to speak, there consist of 20 seconds playing and the rest timeouts, of course. So,
yeah.
But going back to sort of what would be likely to happen is that in order to avoid totally unfair or improper impacts of a shot clock, you would have to have so many exceptions in terms of when they get a new set of 30 seconds or whatever, depending on illegal action on the part of defense, actually genuinely attempts to shoot, the goalkeeper deflects the ball out again, or you shoot and hit the crossbar, or someone stops a bounce pass with a foot, or something like that. You would have a sort of whole network of rules that created exceptions from the shot clock, and that that might also be a difficulty. But let's speculate, talk about that again if and when the idea possibly gets some more momentum.
All right, I agree. Let's move on to the next rule, and it's some changes to how the last minute, or you could say the last 30 seconds of a game will be played.
Yep.
And we've discussed this before, haven't we?
Well, we have, and of course I'm, taking a personal interest in this because when the existing rule up to this point was introduced, I was the one behind it, who sort of got so fed up together with some of my colleagues that concluded that we had to have a special rule for the absolutely final stage of the game to really deter gross and sportsmanlike actions and sabotage to take away the final chance for an opponent. And we did it in a form then that sort of seemed to have some impact, but gradually has been found not to have been enough impact. So now there's a new twist to it.
Can I get a mea culpa?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, you made my day, Krister.
I mean, the idea of doing something was clear cut. meaning that we wanted to try to find a method of discouraging, and again, and that goes back to my comments at the outset, something that by its mere existence, a rule discourages this kind of behavior. Right. But what we found, of course, was that if the rule essentially means that someone was guilty of this kind of sabotage,
Christopher, let me yeah. jump in. We didn't really explain.
That's what happened. I was about to do.
Oh, okay, my bad. You go ahead. Talk about the sabotage.
To start
that
with
seen.
What we have had. What we have had was a rule where under the last 60 seconds, if you sabotage, particularly in a situation where the ball was not in play, I mean, someone was trying to, you know, take a throw off after having had the opponent score a goal, and they have their final attack coming up and 20, 30, 40 seconds left, and someone rushes up there and just grabs them or pulls them down, and even if the referee stopped the clock, the final chance was taken away because the defense goes back down in position on the other side, and there is no serious goal scoring chance left to tie the game or to win the game by one if it was just tied. So the idea then was that, well, if we do something really drastic, if we say that this player doesn't just get disqualified, which in terms of meaning right there and then, it means simply that he's out for the rest of the game, but that he furthermore gets reported and suspended for the next game, then that really ought to do the trick. He really ought to stop and think before he takes this action. But it didn't really, because, you know, if you can win a game or at least tie a game at the end, the price isn't that tremendous if it means that a player sits out the next game, because that might be not be all that critical.
Right.
So, also, you know, that the impact was then in a game, it didn't help the poor team that was the object of this sabotage and who lost their final chance. It helped the next opponent who had to play the game without this opponent who got suspended. So the form of punishment didn't work, and therefore the idea was we should come up with something that has immediate effect and is more directly related to restoring this opportunity that this player takes away.
Right. And that's for those of you keeping score at home like I am. That's where I was saying, like, you got to give a guy a 7-meter throw. That's the only way to solve this. And that's what I have been advocating ever since I started seeing players get tackled in the last few seconds of a game. I'm like, oh, this is crazy. And, you know, that's why I'm really happy to see this penalty now. You know, you're going to get reported. You're going to give the other team a 7-meter throw.
Well, you are not going to get reported. I mean, it's not a double punishment. I mean, the notion of being suspended for the next game doesn't any longer exist.
Okay. Well, but nobody's going to do it anymore because that is
the ultimate illustration of a rule that we hope that we will not have to use a lot, because if before the player was cynical and said, well, I don't care about a red card and a suspension, but I sure care. I mean, what's the point of doing what I'm about to do if I know that they are getting a better chance? Because that's my only little qualm with this rule, and you and I have discussed it before. It could mean that when we now, under today's rules, generally say that a 7-meter is only ever given when a team has a clear goal-scoring chance destroyed by the opponent, basically being up there on the 6-meter line alone with a goalie or something like that. Now we could have a 7-meter if the player is stupid enough to do it. Nevertheless, we could have a 7-meter in an absolutely absurd situation where there are just a few seconds left on the clock and the team would not have had a chance to get up and gain a true scoring opportunity, and because they're in the back half of their own half of the court, and someone does something stupid, and suddenly the referee marches over 35 meters to the other end and gives a 7 meter.
I see that as extremely unlikely, though.
I mean, if it does happen, it may make people wonder how on earth could that warrant a 7 meter. But again, the point is to start with, as you already said, we hope that this finally will put a stop to this stupid action.
Yeah. And for those of you who follow handball a little bit less, the situation that we're talking about is 5 or 6 seconds, 10, 15 seconds left in the game. A team, typically what would happen, a team would be throwing it in after a goal was scored. And, you know, they would just, like, tackle the guy. So you could not get a good initial pass off. Defense could set up. A few more seconds get run off before, you know, basically a player would get a 2 minute. Now the penalty is a 7 meter throw.
Yep.
And I don't know what the EHF is going to do now. They won't have to issue any more of these little notices about at the end of the game, so-and-so is suspended for the next game. Let's hope that they don't have to anymore, because we're not going to see any more of this silliness.
So. Well, we'll get to that when we come to the fifth and final rule change here in a moment. But, no, I hope it will have the intended effect, and then I will be perfectly happy with the rule. The only thing that I'm a little bit pleased with my own vanity here is that when I heard that there was finally determination to go for the 7 meter route as a punishment, that I was able to influence it so that the people involved with these changes here cut it back from 60 seconds to 30 seconds. Because
I think that's legitimate. I think that's enough time.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, to give a 7 meter for something that happens with 58 seconds to go and 3 attacks still to come potentially or something like that is really a little bit excessive. But if we are talking about those sort of really desperate final 10, 20, perhaps 30 seconds, then it makes sense.
What about a side question here? I can't remember the Austrian coach of Hypo and that silly move he made.
Oh yeah, well,
would this have any impact? Would this have any relation to that? And I guess maybe you can explain the situation I'm talking about.
Well, it was a coach who simply stepped into the court to stop an attack with a pass to a totally free player in a fast break along the sideline. I mean, for sure. I mean, if it happened in this particular situation, the final 30 seconds would be a part of the rule. That's no doubt about that.
All right, but if the coach tackled at 40 seconds,
fortunately, after all that commotion, we haven't seen, to my knowledge, that kind of situation ever again.
Let's hope we never see it again. Yeah. So we're in pretty solid agreement on this rule, that it's a good one, and it's going to end a lot of silliness.
Yep, let's hope so.
So let's talk a little bit about the blue card.
Well, I mean, you should, of course, be able to claim that you were one of the first ones who saw it, because we used that as an illustration in my write-up in an article in the Team Handball News several years ago. And you could say that, well, heavens, I mean, it's getting to be too much here. It's another little mea culpa that I've been trying to sort of rectify something that didn't work out quite as we had hoped. You remember, of course, the old rule that was called exclusion, and where the referee had a hand signal that we never ever saw, crossed arms over his head, which meant that the player was, heaven forbid, thrown out for the rest of the game for 10 minutes or 45 or 59 and a half minutes in an extreme case for something really outrageous, a very serious, dangerous foul or gross unsportsmanlike conduct.
So, of course,
it was a punishment that the referees never used So that's why we decided quite a number of years ago now that we do away with this, and we instead have two forms of disqualification.
Well, let's back up a second. Explain what was before. You essentially had two versions of a red card.
That's what we had now up to this point. But I'm talking about even further back. But what led to the two versions of red card? We had for decades in handball a punishment that was sort of similar to a red card in soccer, meaning that you are out for the rest of the game, which of course in soccer 11 against 10 is bad enough, but in handball totally would distort the game. And it sort of was a rule that only existed on paper. The referees never used it really. They just gave a disqualification, a red card, and the effect on the court was 2 minutes, which was clearly not enough of a punishment for some of the most outrageous behavior. And that's where we introduced two forms of disqualification, so-called with report for the more serious ones and without report. Without report signifying that it was the player was out for the rest of the game, the team played shorthanded for 2 minutes, and that was the end of the story. And the one with report was then to give the federation involved, the disciplinary committee or whatever, the option after the game to tack on one or several games suspension. And that is what we still have. But the problem was that when we said that it's two forms of disqualification, and this we have the same method for showing it to the rest of the world, namely with a red card, then it created lots of uncertainty and room for manipulation afterwards. Well, was it with or without report? Because the referees simply would go to the table and to the official in charge of the team involved and explain verbally. And of course, that meant that people in the stands and on TV, watching on TV, were pretty clueless. So that's where I came up with the idea that we have to separate that and have a separate indication. And that was where this sort of, you know, blue, purplish, angry blue card, if you wish, would signify that there will be a report.
Yes.
So it's not a rules change. It's simply a method of showing the decision.
A little transparency.
Yeah.
In effect, that the referees have to make a decision on the spot. Hey, you know, the difference between this was a bad foul, it's worthy of a red card, and the player needs to leave the game, versus this was very egregious. The tournament committee is going to have to make a decision about this guy playing in the next game or future games.
Yeah.
And so now that decision will be made on the spot after it happens.
Yeah. Except that, unfortunately, I tried to use a little bit of my informal influence, but it didn't come out the way I had hoped. You described it rather correctly, that the referees make that decision. Is it sort of a foul that is under that paragraph or this other paragraph? Just like they normally, you know, decide, is it yellow card versus two minutes? They decide, is it red card versus blue card? But the way it has now been prescribed is that in all cases, they first show the red card, and then in a sort of second phase, and what's even worse to my mind, after possible consultation via headsets, which of course they have at the top levels, or by going to talk with the match supervisor, that they allow an outsider to have some influence whether it should be red or blue. And if it should be blue, then they pull the blue card as a second step. And that's what I don't like, because to my mind, it should plain and simple be a referee decision. It's either red or blue, not red, and then possibly adding on blue.
Well, and you know, I guess, you know, here is where you could, again, if you wanted to take the NBA as an example, when they will have a kind of a post-game investigation by the head office where they will decide what the impact is on the next game. Now, in defense of that possibility, you can watch videos from different angles and make a more informed decision, whereas the ref might not have seen how egregious something was, or maybe from his vantage point, it made something look worse than it was.
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know my attitude, that I would be all in favor for wherever it's possible to go much further in video review and in handball. But that would mean in a case like this that the referees could go themselves and watch it on a screen and decide that, well, red is not enough, it has to be blue.
Right.
So that would be fine. Or if, you know, it was a situation that I did not even see at all, and someone who sits in a different position discovers that something happens behind their backs and reports it to them, and they decide, well, in that case, it has to be a red or a blue, whichever. That's fine. But not that someone, you know, as it were, second guesses or interferes with what should plain and simple be their decision on the court, and without the help of video, and without giving them a second and chance. That's my gripe about it. But I mean, that's may turn out not to become too much of an issue. But what I hope it means is that we get consistency around the world, because that has been a problem. Like the European Federation, in all their competitions, they went totally against this rule for many years now. When the referees showed red and then told everyone that it's no report will follow, that should, according to IHF rules, be the end of it. Or not just should, but must, as it were. But the European Federation still took upon themselves to say that, well, we don't care if the referees didn't submit a report. We put our disciplinary committee to work anyway, and basically, in other words, override the decision of the referees. And I have some faint hope that now, when the whole world can see whether it's red or blue in the end, that the EHF stops this practice getting into further punishment suspensions when it's not a blue card.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, I can see pros and cons for some after-game discussion versus no after-game discussion.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think this is, overall rather simple fix.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this
you described.
This is not a rules change. That's why I said we really have 4.5 items here. This is just sort of, changing a signal, basically, not the rule and the decision making.
Well, all right, Krister.
Well, one thing that has come to mind that we haven't picked up on, but I mentioned a bit at the outset, and I didn't then go back and point out where it applies. You know, rule about 7 court players instead of goalkeeper. That one has now had a caveat written into the rule book, so that it has even gone beyond what I had thought would be appropriate. It basically says that IHF, continental federations, and national federations decide whether and where this should apply. To my mind, I mean, if IHF introduces this kind of rule, obviously it must be used in all IHF competitions, but they've even given themselves an out. Well, I think if something is used in IHF events, it ought to be used in continental championships. But I fully agree that for the national level, whether they think that this is a workable rule, in particular, youth and grassroots level, that's fine, because that was one of the big complaints that came up about that rule.
Sure.
And well, similarly, about the rule with the injured player having to come out, there it has been decided in the rule text that national federations are allowed to deviate from this rule at the youth level specifically.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, of course it makes sense. I mean, in most countries, they're almost offended to have IHF tell them that this rule is needed in their country, because they say the way our players behave, we don't need this rule at any level. But certainly, I mean, to suggest that, you know, that coaches and teams indoctrinate their 8 or 10 year olds to behave in a way that requires this.
Sure. Sure.
That of course is a real nonsense.
Well, all right, Krister, thanks for sharing that additional nugget of information as well. I bet this isn't the last we hear of these rules, and maybe there'll be some modifications on down the pipe. But it's been great talking with you, and we'll see if we can chat a few times during the Olympics and get some feedback on how the tournament is progressing, both on how the teams are doing, and then maybe we'll touch base on these rules again.
I hope so, yes.
All right. So this is John Ryan, and signing out with Krister Aull. Thanks for listening.